are back. Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. Glad to have you with us. My name is Henrik. I'm from Sweden, and the website is redicecreations.com. You guys remember the program we did with Dave and Kim Dortch not too long ago about the battles they're waging with the police in Murrieta, Riverside County in California, the harassment, the corruption in the legal system, and everything else. Well, part of that story was concerning the CPS, Child Protective Services, and their actions, their part, you know, how they were complicit in many of the problems that they currently face. Well, today we're going to examine that in some more detail and speak with a former employee of the CPS. Carlos Morales is a writer and he runs the Truth Over Comfort podcast. He's a child rights advocate who's spoken at Liberty Forum, Liberty Fest, and others regarding his former work as a child protective services investigator and how to protect children from a state that has turned on its own people and no longer looking out for our interests. His activism has appeared on Fox News and MSNBC and has written for Strike the Root and Lou Rockwell and others. The book he's written is called Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, wherein he exposes the dangerous tactics and overt corruption that he's witnessed as a CPS investigator. We'll discuss some of the background to why he wanted to become a CPS investigator. Of course, we're going to talk about some of the cases that he was involved in, what he saw, but also the education of the agents and the investigators, what they are told. And a little bit later, he'll break down exactly what families should do to protect themselves from this monolithic agency that has destroyed the lives of both children and parents. Hey, Carlos, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Good to talk with you today. It's great to have you here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
And thanks to Brett Vinod as well, who was with us here a while back for helping us to get in touch with you as well. He mentioned your case just kind of in passing, really. We just got into that a little bit, and I wanted to bring you on to talk more about it because it's such a important issue of the child protective services in the United States, what they've been up to and everything. And as far as I know, it's not that often that we actually get someone speaking out in the capacity that you have. So tell us first when you started to work for the CPS, as they're known for short, and what attracted you to this line of work, Carlos.
So it's interesting. A lot of people that I talk to regarding child protective services now, well, at least the ones who are a bit knowledgeable, go, well, how the hell would a libertarian end up working for CPS? Which is a fair question to someone who actually did some research. But essentially, a couple of years back, I was in a college going for sociology, i.e., you know, a degree in buzzwords. And I started gathering some information and getting educated on the idea of the way that children are being raised in America and other countries. Namely from individuals like Stephen Molyneux, Alice Miller, a lot of these other individuals who are basically bringing up the fact that the way children are raised directly affects how society ends up being. And as I was a libertarian and I was into the non-aggression principle, I came to the recognition that the way that children are being raised, well, that was directly affecting all of society. If we wanted to change society, we needed to change the way that people were raising their kids. So there, I ended up having a few altercations in public where I had witnessed parents actually, you know, physically really beating the hell out of their kids. And so I took it upon myself to try to step in and stop them from hitting their kids. Now, after getting pushed and pulled and yelled at a number of times, I started thinking, well, I need to work for an agency that supposedly was created in order to prevent child abuse. So right after I got to college, I decided to throw in an application for child protective services. Prior to this, I had some experience working at a facility where I interviewed children who were physically and sexually molested. And that was kind of my work experience in regards to children before that. But after working for Child Protective Services and really seeing the corruption involved there, not only on the normal end of, you know, how you kind of think of money being thrown here, money being thrown there, but actually just the horrendous incentives to destroy children and parents' lives that I saw, that I really got really shaken up. And then when I quit working for the agency and started researching even more, I started to realize just how terrible this agency truly is.
Yeah, there's so many cases of this. You know, it's just incredible. And so as far as you're concerned, do you know if you're one of the only ones who've actually spoken up in this capacity about being a prior employee of these services agencies?
It's pretty much me. You know, the only other people who have really come out have been these kind of willy-nilly reformers who state that the only bad part about child protective services is that they're overworked, they're understaffed, and they don't have enough money. Well, if you go ahead and check the facts, just like whenever you check the facts regarding public education, there's plenty of money. The problem is not only the incentives, but the entire system itself that needs to be taken down.
Let's kind of dive into this a little bit and talk about some of the cases that you were involved in. I don't know how much you can talk about it, if you signed any, you know, non-disclosure agreements, if there's certain things you can't talk about, or are you pretty much free and open to discuss everything that went on in there?
To be quite honest, I don't even know what I can and cannot get in trouble for anymore. I mean, I've brought up so many terrible things regarding child protective services.
Yeah.
For the sake of families that I worked with, I don't ever, of course, reveal things like names, because if cases ever get opened up on them again, well, then, you know, what am I doing here? Who am I really helping?
Sure. Well, exactly. No, that's not what we're asking for here either. Just more curious and interesting to know, I guess, what kind of procedure you went through. Was it fairly easy to become one of these agents? Was it a long background check? Is there anything you can say about that?
Well, okay, so they do your normal, you know, criminal background check. But, you know, after I decided to turn in my application, I was sent the survey with a bunch of questions, you know, basically trying to figure out if you're crazy or not, and if you toe the line as a whole. And whenever I started going in for training, I realized that they were taking pretty much anyone with a bachelor's degree. There was a guy with a degree in saxophone from Berkeley. And we're talking about people who are not exactly knowledgeable of the minds of children. And with a whole 2 months of training, we're supposed to be able to handle disputes. We have to understand child development, psychology, and forensics. 2 months of training. But in actuality, the vast majority of the time that we're there, all we were really learning about were a few little procedures, ways of getting the answers that we want, and basically being taught that all parents are going to be liars and most of them are, you know, just awful individuals.
Right. Now, tell us a bit about one of the, I guess, the classic cases. What happens and what occurs? I know that it goes from basically anybody, right, can actually call and report someone. And that's basically the premise of what could get you in trouble. How would a typical case play out?
Okay. So essentially, all that has to happen is someone has to make a phone call to Child Protective Services headquarters. Now, this person can decide to name themselves or they can choose to be anonymous. But in either case, the parent will never know the accuser, which is unconstitutional. But hey, who cares about that piece of shit? So essentially, the reasons can be that the parent is homeschooling the child, that the child is playing outside for too long, that the child is too fat or too thin, or in rare cases for actual abuse. Now, it should be kept in mind that 78% of removals within the United States done by Child Protective Services are not for physical or sexual abuse. They're for something called negligence. We'll get into the negligence thing later, but as we'll find and discover, the vast majority of cases revolve around the use of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after this intake is taken, then one of these really smart, intelligent, and witty investigators goes out to try to decipher fact from fiction. Generally, what they do is they go out to talk to the child first. The reason why they're talking to the child first is because according to Child Protective Services and according to every state in the United States, the parent does not own the child. The state does. It's under the auspices of parens patriae, the legal term meaning that the government has a mandate to help all minors and those who are legally unfit to take care of themselves. Now, after this investigator goes out, they generally go out to the public school to speak to the child. Now, the child will then, you know, be taken to a random room by this investigator. The investigator will then ask, can I record the conversation, right? Now, mind you, a five-year-old is capable of consent in this particular case, according to Child Protective Services. So that's generally how it starts.
Yeah.
The investigator then asks the child a barrage of vanilla questions like, what's your favorite color? What is your favorite kind of thing to do on any given day? And then you jump into questions like, I don't know, how often do you touch your father's genitalia, right? So you start, you know, really, really hitting on these particular questions. And whether it's conscious or unconscious, generally the investigator is just trying to get the answer that they want. Because whenever they see that packet, what do they see on that packet? Sometimes they'll see, oh, well, it's alleged that this child is being molested, that the parents are snorting cocaine off of hookers' bums. I mean, it can be an allegation of many, many different things. And all these things are playing a part into the mind of the investigator. And the investigator, well, what does he want to be? He wants to be a hero. And if you really want to see where this can go bad when it comes to false reports and false allegations, all you got to do is look up the, do you remember in the 1990s, the satanic ritualistic abuse that was supposedly everywhere?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so there was supposedly 1,000 satanic ritualistic abuse allegations across the United States over the course of about 8 or 10 years, late 80s and early 90s. It was based off this book called Michelle Remembers, right? And essentially one of the biggest cases where this was occurring was in California. Now, investigators were called out to a daycare facility. It was alleged that these daycare workers were beating and molesting these children in the name of the great Satan. Now, after a bit of coaching by investigators, what ended up coming out was that these daycare workers were flying around the room on brooms. They were shoving machetes up the asses of babies, that they were flushing these children down the toilets, that Chuck Norris actually came up from hell and decapitated a child. Like, that's how ridiculous these accusations were. Mm. But what did CPS investigators do? Well, they pushed those ones on the backdrop, and they just brought up, oh, well, all these children are now being molested in this particular case. And how did they get these questions? Well, one of the ways they did it was by leading the witness. So let's say it's me and little Timmy. Now I'm going to tell Timmy, hey, Tim, you know, your friend John told me that Paco was touching both of you in your private parts. Now, your friend, he's a really, really smart guy, and I like him a lot. Are you going to be a good little boy and tell me the same thing? That is word for word things that they would actually tell these individuals, right? Mm-hmm. So you're leading the question on.
Yeah.
You're making them want to give you the correct answer because, you know, they're kids. They want to give you the right answer. So after a $6 million case, which was the most expensive case in California's history, finally, everyone was basically taken out of prison and no one ended up getting in trouble after some real investigations. But do you know what happened to those investigators who made up these false allegations?
Mm-mm.
Nothing. Not only that, they got a 1,500% increase in federal funding, right?
Yeah.
Because failure equals money in the eyes of the state.
It always does, right? If it's a hole that, you know, oh, is missing here. Okay, more money to fill that hole, you know, that's what they do, right?
Yeah. The same thing happens in public education. You know, just as well as I do, you know, there's been an increase in funding of public education over the last 30 years that is unbelievable. I mean, I think it was something along the lines of a 1,200% increase per student over the last 30 years, yet the literacy rate has gone down. And every single liberal that you talk to will just tell you, oh, well, it's just because they don't have enough money right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So every single time, the great reformers are simply asking for more and more and more money. And that's what's happened with Child Protective Services and social workers. There was a recent case in Vermont that I was really researching where these two children died in foster care. And the head of Child Protective Services was fired because, you know, whenever too many injustices occur, an old man must be sacrificed at the altar of the state. But what happened was, of course, he still got his pension. And then what he said was, well, I want the social workers to come out and, you know, really fight for what's true. So all the social workers who are called whistleblowers in the media, all they simply stated was they didn't state we need to get rid of the drug war. They didn't state that they're wrongfully removing children on a constant basis. What do they state? We're working too much and we're not making enough money.
Yeah.
And that's always, I mean, they're just lying out of their teeth. By the way, just so I know, what are the rules in regards to cursing on this show?
You can curse however much you want. So no worries about that. No, God. What is it? FCC it's called in America? Is that what
No, no FCC. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I just needed to double check.
No worries about that. I'll try to keep it civil, but it's fine. No.
Oh, yeah. It's like occasionally just kind of comes out and I'm like, what's another word for ass?
Yeah. Yeah. Donkey. All right. So is this what you did then? Are these the kind of questions that you asked? And I guess a follow-up to that, Do you know who came up with the protocol of doing it in this way?
Well, the protocols are set by different states, right? Essentially, every couple of years, a new group of bureaucrats will come up with new ways by talking to psychologists and one another in order to be able to figure out better ways to ask questions of children. Supposedly, we're being taught to not be biased, right? So there was supposedly some things that were learned during the satanic ritualistic abuse allegations. Namely, CBS investigators were actually telling children, well, if something like this was to happen, what would happen? Which is so leading and so asking for imagination that it is just absurd. So generally, we didn't go for things that bad on that end. But to be quite honest, even if we were doing our jobs legitimately, it's still immoral. Because one of the main things that we went after parents over was drugs, right? So you could have a parent who admitted to smoking marijuana while he was at his friend's house when he wasn't even around the kid, and they can end up removing the child. And finally, you know, some of this information is getting out to the public. There's a really, really tragic story recently that occurred in September where a baby that was taken from parents after father admitted to using marijuana was murdered in foster care. The foster parent that the baby was placed with actually had been a known crack cocaine user. And she was 20 years old. That's the person they decided to give it to, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, you know, if you hit your child, right, which I'm definitely not one for using violence against children. In a lot of cases, you can still keep your kid. That's fine, according to the state. The main problem is, oh, well, you decided to smoke a little bit of weed, and then we remove you based off of that. And I just think that alone should tell you right there the problem with CPS.
Well, exactly. And it's just the bottom line that they have that capability of getting in and completely changing your life and uprooting families in this way. I mean, and in some cases, the rules of what is considered acceptable to them could also, I guess, change at any point. Not only with the false questions, of course, leading the child and all these things, which is very dangerous in itself. But even the way, let's say, that maybe a child wants to, and as you said there, I'm not for hitting children, not at all. But let's say discipline or setting boundaries or what have you. At whatever point, you know, can CPS come in and say, nope, that's we don't approve of that, and therefore we're going to take your child from you. I mean, anything is possible with what we've seen so far, correct?
Yeah, and not only that, there's another issue when it comes to the issue of evidence gathering by Child Protective Services. I'm sure you're aware of the issue with eyewitness testimony, right? So there's been studies where they've had, you know, a number of supposed witnesses walking away from a car crash. They hear the car crash, then they turn around and they see it. When a cop starts asking them questions in a specific type of manner, they're then able to explain exactly what it looked like whenever the car crash took place, even though they didn't actually see it. Hmm. And it's because of the leading questions that they're asking them.
Yeah.
Now, Child Protective Services, you know, it even becomes worse than that, because what could be considered evidence is the memory of someone else. So we can have a case where it states, well, this man overheard last year that this other person was smoking marijuana. Now they're bringing up this report. So you're dealing with the memory of the memory of the memory of someone else who overheard something a year ago. And there's a simple game that can kind of show you the problem with this, and it's called the telephone game.
Yep.
Right? So I'm little Johnny, and I'm talking to my friend Ted here. I tell him five words, and he says to another person, says to another person, says to another person. And by the time the game is done, you end up with a completely different message. But in this particular case, instead of an insightful giggle, you end up with the removal of a child, right? So that's the issue when it comes to memory. Eyewitness testimony, I mean, it's really annoying to me how much the media still makes that sound like it's a good idea. Our memories are a bit of a tricky thing, and they can easily be weaseled around. Now, then you also have the incentives for people to make false allegations. For instance, a mom in a divorce trial can say that the dad was sexually abusing a child, right? And a case can start. She can end up getting the custody before the case is even closed. It's proven that it's false, yet that still looks like a demerit because it's, well, how do we know the molestation wasn't really occurring and CPS just couldn't show that it was happening, right?
Yeah.
So you have that incentive to lie in divorce court. You can have a neighbor. There was a case I was working with where the neighbor stated that their neighbor was snorting cocaine with hookers at their home in front of their children, right? And that there was guns everywhere. Well, I went to the person's house. There was no cocaine, right? There weren't guns everywhere. And the people that I spoke to, none of them seemed to believe that this was the case. And when I talked to the neighbor, he admitted that he made it up. He just stated, well, I didn't like them and I knew there was something wrong with them.
Yeah, there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
Then you have teachers, and this is the worst one. You have teachers who state that a child has ADHD and that because the parent isn't giving them psychotropic drugs that completely destroy their will, well, they're being medically negligent to that child. And then you can end up with some of these cases where, you know, cops are coming out to a parent's house for removal because they weren't giving their child stimulants while in public indoctrination camps.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Well, I mean, that's how we have to view it when you realize what really is going on here. So tell us how much, let's say, could you do when it comes to, let's say, finding evidence for a claim then, let's say that, okay, someone is using cocaine, what have you. Did you like show up with the police and you had, you know, search warrants and you could actually look through the entire place, or how did that play out there?
No, essentially, I mean, there's a few different ways of going around it. Warrants are rarely given out. In fact, you can never get a warrant if it's an anonymous report, depending on the state, right? So what we could do, though, is we could drug test parents. And I always recommend that parents don't do this if you use drugs. But, you know, we can we go down to a parent's house and we have these little oral swab drug tests. We say, hey, I'm from Child Protective Services. I was told that you were using illicit substances. You know, we're going to have to drug test you right now. I put this oral swab drug test, I throw it in their mouth and see if they're high. Funny thing about those tests are that they're generally pretty terrible. Mainly because it's hard to catch someone for crystal meth, but it's really, really easy to catch someone for weed. So there was one guy who put the oral swab drug test in his mouth. Then he tested negative, and then he immediately admitted that he was high on meth whenever he did the test.
Right.
Like, you idiot.
Right.
But not exactly the kind of guy I want to be a parent, but you know what I mean. So we could do oral swab drug tests. In other cases, we could just simply say, hey, we want to look around the house in order to see that you aren't using cocaine, right? And with most parents, in their minds, they just go, well, I'm a good parent, therefore I'll just do what this guy has to say and then everything's going to be fine. Or even worse, I'll admit that I'm doing a bunch of things that are considered wrong according to the law. And then he'll go away because he'll know that I'm an honest, good person. And that's one of the greatest mistakes that people make. That's the mistake that guy, the man who died at the recent death of Angel, the baby in regards to the child that was removed from a home for the parent using marijuana and being handled over to that that disgusting foster parent. The father admitted to using marijuana because in his mind it was like, well, I'll just tell him the truth and then it'll be fine.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I certainly don't recommend people do that.
What about those who, let's say, don't cooperate then? Maybe, you know, they're trying to challenge them on this or what have you. Is that something that could lead them deeper in trouble? Basically, you know, the agents, maybe even the police have a point of trying to make an example out of that those people. Did that ever occur?
It kind of depends. And I'd like to, if we can hold up just a little bit on that one, because what I'd really like to do and a little bit here is do recommendations for how to deal with Child Protective Services.
Right. Yeah.
I could think it would be really, really helpful. I would just like to go a little bit more into the topic of incentives, though, and evidence. Because when we're talking about Child Protective Services, we're talking about these marijuana cases, we talk about all these other things. Generally, what people bring up is that, you know, we're talking about a few bad apples. You know, it's just a couple bad guys. It's overall, though, it's a really necessary system. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I fundamentally disagree with it in the same way that I disagree that, you know, the military industrial complex, well, that's just a few bad apples. It's not that bad. We need the military industrial complex, right? Obviously, we don't. And the really evil thing here is the incentive structure of Child Protective Services. Now, it's not bad enough that, you know, taxes are coercively gotten, right? It's stolen money, right? You take money from a parent through force, then you use that money to pay a CPS investigator who then takes your child away. So there's already that problem. Then there's something called the 1997 Safe Family Adoption Act, right? Which granted federal money to state agencies for every removal that CPS would do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Nancy Schaefer brought this up, who sadly passed away. She was a congresswoman. But essentially, a CPS investigator removes a child from a home, and then the state gives the federal government, then gives that state agency more money. And it gets even worse when you think about the fact that they then grant them even more money if the child has a disability, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, what the government considers disabilities, though, well, that's kind of vague, right? Because according to them, mental health disorders are disabilities. And that's when you get into the topic of foster homes and drugging. So let me do a for example real quick. You're a kid, you're 5 years old, you've just been removed from your home, your community, your church. You've just been placed into a foster home where children are 7 to 8 times more likely to be abused than if they stayed in a normal household. They're 50% more likely to be homeless than children in similar economic situations. They're more likely to get post-traumatic stress disorder than veterans of war. They're more likely to go to jail than children who were being abused in a normal household. And they're 6 times more likely to die than if they stayed in an abusive household, right? Those are some pretty rough statistics when it comes to foster homes. So you've just been tossed into there. So maybe you're having some night terrors. Maybe you're getting into arguments with other individuals. Maybe you're not acting well in school. We would call that situational depression, sadness due to the environment. But according to a state mental health doctor, that child has ADHD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, insomnia, and they'll, you know, make sure to pop you on enough pills to make you shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's why you end up with these kids who are 3 times more likely to be put on psychotropic drugs than children in similar economic scenarios. By the way, I realize I just threw out a lot of statistics there. All stats in regards to this can be found at legallykidnapped.net, which is where you can also find the book. So that's just good to know. But yeah, the information of foster homes, I mean, it is absolutely disgraceful what's going on in those places. And yet again, people bring up underfunding in those foster homes, and that's just a lie. I mean, these children are being beaten and molested and drugged in these fucking foster homes because their parents decided to smoke marijuana or someone lied about it, right? We're talking about an agency that is a domestic terrorist cell within the United States. And it's something that very few libertarians are talking about because it's not affecting a large percentage of libertarians, right?
Right.
Because who's Child Protective Services going after, right? They're going after minorities. They're going after people with not very much money. They're going after people who don't speak English, for instance, handing them over paperwork that's in English and telling them to sign it so that nothing bad will happen to them, right? But there's 397,000 children in Child Protective Services care right now.
Give us that number again. Give us that number.
397,000 children in out-of-home care right now.
There you go.
Yeah.
Tell us about the placement here then. Have you gotten any closer to how this could go so horribly wrong without any checks and you know, measures in place of trying to prevent these kids from ending up in the wrong hands? It seems like it's a machine intended to make sure that these kids end up in the wrong hands. Is that the case?
Well, you know, whenever it comes to government bureaucrats and bureaucracies in general, the intent no longer matters to me, right? Because many of these people have the best of intentions. They think, oh, well, I'm helping them in this particular case. And in all honesty, I could give a damn what their intentions are because we all know what the road to hell is paved with, right?
Yeah.
So in these particular cases, you know, it's hard to state whether or not they're doing it on purpose. I don't believe they're purposely sticking them in homes where they're going to be regularly abused. But I think they turn the other way, and they are set up in situations where, you know, you're just normal bureaucratic individuals with very little education, who are power hungry and just want to go home so they can masturbate and watch the NFL and get fat, right? These are the kind of people that we're dealing with.
Hmm.
I don't believe that, as Alex Jones kind of calls them, you know, they're satanic, child molesting pedophiles. I don't think that's most CPS investigators. I think most of them are just idiots.
Now, were you kind of taught any of this morality that as an agent is like you're doing, you know, really solid work here. We're saving these kids.
Oh, yeah. We're saving the children. Yeah. We're thinking in the best interests of children as a whole, right? This is what you're told repeatedly. You're told this story that you are the great hero that is here to save children. And that's been the history of progressivism, you know, since the late 1800s, early 1900s up until now. Right? The actual results of your actions matter very little to what the culture believes that you're actually doing. So no matter how much you fuck up, you can always state, well, I had the best interest of children in mind.
Yeah. And you can do anything in the name of that, of course. But we do have that kind of attitude a little bit, or it's creeping in, I'd say, more and more, basically that your own children do not longer any belong to you, right? We even had a news anchor on MSNBC talking about this. Your children do not belong to you anymore. It's a communal thing, and we're going to decide what's best for them, right? And this mentality is kind of creeping into government, and it's increasingly so in America that used to be more, you know, individualistic, I would say. But it seems like it's turning its back on that, and it's through these type of organizations and agencies that you get this kind of mentality enforced in people. Because also think about the other side to this. When people hear about these kinds of stories, they're totally scared into submission. That would be a nightmare if that happened to my kids. So whatever I have to do to, you know, appeal to what they want me to do, or even how, you know, they want me to raise my own child, I'll abide by those rules. So that now we're in the territory kind of self-inflicted, we can't call it censorship, but behavior, basically. You're inflicting that behavior on yourself and on your own kids to save them from potentially being, you know, hauled off by the state, right?
Well, yeah, it's a large thing, right? Because in order to be able to enforce a lot of things Child Protective Services is doing, there has to be a culture of fear around it, right? Because someone is making that phone call that's stating it's bad that, you know, little Jimmy is riding his bike two blocks away from his parents' house, right? Because the media, it's taught to all of us that there are child molesters everywhere who just want to kidnap your kids, and that state agents and cops are good people, right? And in truth, it's now safer for a child than ever to deal with normal strangers while outside. It's less violent in that particular case. But now it's more dangerous when dealing with state officials than ever.
Yeah.
And so the culture of fear is really being placed in the wrong, you know, part of society, in the wrong thought process as far as that's concerned.
And it's kind of isolating children as well, I feel. It's like with all these kind of, you know, pedophile stories and things like this going around, you know, we've kind of seen a hardened relationship between, you know, specifically, of course, men or older men and children, even, a random guy talking to a child in the street. Some people will, you know, look at that with weird eyes and like, oh my God, you know. So it's really kind of atomizing everybody and creating, it's separating the sense of, you know, community and belonging at the same time, which I think is another ulterior motive that they do have in mind for control purposes, you know?
Well, yeah. If you isolate everyone, right? If you remove any of the kind of the positive tribal mindsets as far as communities actually looking out for one another, rather than always trying to externalize it to the state, whenever you remove the locus of control from the individual and onto this coercive paternalistic bureaucracy, well, that's how it's so much easier to control individuals. So both the media and the government get to, you know, reign free whenever everyone is living in fear, because you're constantly watching television to see which child molester is going to take your child next. And the government gets to rake in money by stating, well, since there's so many child molesters here, we need even more money and we need even more power. They're both winning.
Yeah, it's one of those cases again where if they were actually lessen some of these threats, it would, you know, not be well on these agencies. They would get less and less money. So the more they can demonstrate that these problems are out there, just as you said, the more money they will get. Ergo, their interest is going to be to perpetuate themselves and expand as an agency. So how people don't kind of realize that is, of course, you know, beyond my reasoning. But there you go.
That to me is kind of the nature of the state, right? Because it gathers everything through force. It has no real forms of competition. So the only way it can gather revenue is by continuously instilling fear in individuals and asking and begging for more and more money. If you don't give them the money, of course, they'll use force anyway. But there has to be a pseudo consent that is created. And it's the very nature of the state and the individuals working within the state to continue to grow and grow and grow and grow. Because if things are getting worse, then in their mind, well, we need to make it bigger, right? We need to make the government bigger because things are getting worse. If things are getting better, well, we need to make it grow because the reason why things are getting better is because the government is growing. In either case, it's why I don't think the idea of a small government is really possible, because the nature of the state is to continue to expand until the point where it gathers all the revenue and destroys all of the populace.
Well, it's kind of gotten out of hand too in terms of what we believe that, you know, because the state has been there to fulfill a task, right? Because I'm not against something like, you know, trying to achieve, you know, security, or let's say when we're in the situation we're in right now with not having to be around our kids all the time. Sure, why won't have something there that can oversee the protection of, you know, the children in the community or what have you. But now it's that this aspect that we do no longer take it upon ourselves to arrange this or make sure that good, decent people end up in this position. We leave it up to a government, which is comprised of people that we don't even know. We don't know their motives or agendas or anything of this. And again, it's more that it's getting further and further away from the local level of decision making. And that's when I think it gets out of hand. The very idea of trying to have safety for your children is obviously not a bad idea, right? But it's about who you're letting, who those protectors are going to be. That's what's wrong here in this picture, I think. Now, let's talk a little bit about the top-down decision-making here and if there's other incentives beyond. We talked a little bit about making money, of course, getting, you know, kids on drugs and SSRIs and, you know, ADHD, all these kinds of issues that they're claiming that they're tackling. We have that as one issue. Then we have the other aspect of kind of isolating people a bit and just kind of creating an environment of where you fear that you can lose your child, which is, you know, changing things, the structure of society. But are there any other incentives, do you think? Because I mean, I still think there has to be some kind of top-down decision-making process here, where they know what they're doing in the line of the agency. Meaning that, sure, you have the agents enforcing some of these things, and they might believe, you know, this is for the greater good. We're doing this because we're the heroes here, right? But someone's got to see the numbers somewhere here, right? I mean, even the data that you're talking about in terms of how many are abused in these foster homes and whatnot. That's known stuff, right? But despite that, nothing is being done about it. So how do we explain that, do you think?
You know, in all honesty, I can take a look at what I'm seeing. I can look at the statistics of what I'm seeing. I can see the evidence. I can see the incentives are. And I can look at that alone and go, okay, I know that there's an issue here. I do not know if it has larger ties, if there's some kind of great conspiracy in order to be able to control these children in a particular way. I know a lot of the individuals who started up things like public education certainly conspired in order to, you know, bring down society from within in order to be able to, you know, move it the way that they wanted it to. But to be quite honest, I'm not sure. And I rather not dabble in things that I'm not completely sure about when I know so much regarding the agency as a whole as it already is. Does that make sense?
Sure, definitely. Now,
do you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to dabble in things that I'm not 100% sure on.
Well, exactly. Meaning you're not in the heads of these people who are running the thing. You don't know. And therefore, exactly. You know, it's not valid to make speculations about it, you know, because we could go the conspiracy route here and say that, yeah, this is intentional. They're doing this to, you know, break up families and all these issues, right? Or they might be thinking that they're doing the right thing. They're just not smart enough to realize the consequences of their work.
Yeah. Well, some of them honestly told me things like, oh, well, you know, they pay really well and I'm going to get an awesome pension.
Right.
A lot of these people just had shitty jobs and they just realized, oh, I get to be kind of a hero here and I'm going to make some money. This is awesome. Oh, by the way, everyone thinks I'm great. Right.
Right.
Because what do they tell Child Protective Service investigators in the United States? When you go up to someone, oh, that's a rough job. That's really hard. You're such a good person for what you do. People just state that shit without realizing what we're actually doing. They do the same thing with cops. You know, they'll tell a cop, oh, it's such a hard job. And then they forget about, oh yeah, I remember that time I was pulled over for going 35 and a 30. And I basically, I guess he did kind of threaten my life for driving 5 miles over the speed limit. you know, they decontextualize all these things and they buy into the hype that these social workers, that these CPS investigators are great martyrs who, under all duress, are still helping society.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, there you go. That's some of the issues we are dealing with here. But let's get into the aspects of how to kind of, how people can protect themselves from some of this, because it's a very, and how, what you suggest in terms of fighting an agency like this and what we need to do to get out of that. I think there'll probably be people out there who think, well, you know, again, we have to do is get the right people in place of an organization like this, and it would be run better, etc. But what's your take on this, and what would your recommendations be to someone who has gotten themselves ensnared, someone has snitched on them, what have you? They might even not like their neighbors, and they've called the CPS on them. How do they protect themselves in this situation?
Okay, so I just so, and I'm sure you're going to bring it up earlier on, but yeah, my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, the book is split up into two sections, and the second section, which is the second part of the entire book, or the second half, is all about how to deal with child protective services. And the most important thing first is to educate yourself on what child protective services is, which is an agency which is not meant to protect you and your child, but instead can, in fact, destroy you and your child and children within the United States as a whole. So recognizing that Child Protective Services is a domestic terrorist organization, first and foremost, that's a good start, right? And then letting your neighbors or your friends or anyone else know what Child Protective Services actually is, so that they see abuse, or if they think something is going on, their first gut reaction is not to call these, you know, these militiamen who will take away children, right? So educating yourself first is important. Secondly, if your child is, say, in public education or public school, let your child know that if a CPS investigator ever comes to talk to them, tell them straight up, I do not want to speak to you. I will only speak with you if I'm with my parents, right? Do not allow private interviews with your child ever. They can manipulate even the smartest of kids to give them information. Right.
So it's very. Sorry to interrupt. But so you're saying basically this is something you might have to prep and educate your child on beforehand, because that might show up at a school, for example, or anywhere where the parents don't have contact with them right away, correct?
Preparation is key with dealing with child protective services. It's why I'm really deeply saddened whenever I get messages from people stating, my kids were moved 2 years ago. I told them all these things I shouldn't have told them. And it's like, wow, if you knew how to prepare, none of this might have happened, right? So preparation is key, right? So knowing what Child Protective Services is, never allowing private interviews with your kids is incredibly important. So if you don't allow private interviews with the kids, if you tell your friends, don't ever talk to Child Protective Services if they ever ask any questions, right? Then the CPS investigators will actually have to come to your house and talk to you. Now, if a CPS investigator does come to your home, you have two options. One of the options is to just simply state, I'm not going to speak to you. You can speak to my attorney, right? You can go that route, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But the other route is to speak to them. Now, there's a few things to keep in mind when dealing with Child Protective Service investigators. Number one, and this is the biggest rule here, record everything. Record all interactions with Child Protective Services investigators at all times, phone calls, everything. But in order to do that, you have to let them know that you're going to record the conversation. So this investigator knocks on your door. Hello, my name is Bianca. I'm from Child Protective Services. I'm here to talk to you about your child. You state, well, my name is Carlos. I'm going to record this conversation between us. Now, secondly, do not let the investigator into your home whatsoever. They can see a few dirty pans and consider that an unfit house for the child to live in. So don't do that. Do the interview outside. Record the interview. When you're having the conversation with the CPS investigator, they're going to try and not actually tell you what the allegations of abuse are, right? They're going to try to weasel their way around it. It's important to try and figure out what the actual investigation is about. So repeatedly ask the investigator, what are the allegations in regards to? Make sure you get that information. That part is absolutely vital, and you have a right to know that information. From there, only answer questions in relation to the allegations, right? Because they're going to want to ask you questions about, oh, well, how were you raised as a child? Were you ever a victim of domestic violence, right? If you were a victim of domestic violence 20 years ago, and that guy's not even that picture anymore, that can still be considered a risk to the CPS investigator that you are not a fit, mentally prepared parent, right? So you don't want to admit, to things like prior drug use. Don't admit to things like prior domestic violence. Don't admit to any of these things because all of those are an admission of guilt. And no amount of, oh, well, I just want to be honest with the person is going to help this particular scenario. So say as little as possible. They're looking for contradictions. Make sure to not contradict what you're stating to them. Don't trust these investigators whatsoever. Don't admit to any kind of, essentially, the most important things is don't contradict. Don't admit to anything that can harm you or your child. Don't take any drug tests if you use drugs whatsoever, and record the entire conversation. And that alone will get you a lot further than most people ever have the chance of getting with these investigators.
You know, I've always been curious about the kind of a, at least on a social level, more lax attitude towards marijuana in the United States as opposed to, let's say, some European countries. But you know, they're talking about trying to make it legal in some states. It's very lax in some states, as far as I have heard anyway. And I've always been curious. I wonder if they're seeking to use that in some capacity, meaning that, you know, it becomes very much.
I got a story for you in regards to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so they're going after parents in California and in Colorado who have medical marijuana licenses, right? So here's the thing. Alcohol is legal in the United States, right? But if you're an alcoholic, CPS can go after you. So marijuana is legal, right, in this particular case? Well, who knows if you using your marijuana, though, is preventing you from being able to be a fit parent, right? Yeah, remember that case I was talking to you just a second ago regarding the baby taken from parents after father admitted using marijuana?
Mm-hmm.
That was in Colorado,
yeah,
where it's legal,
yeah,
right? So they are using this as a way to basically, they're using a medical marijuana license as a license to take away your child. So that's kind of why I recommend, you know, that parents shouldn't post pictures of themselves smoking weed on Facebook.
It's
the little things, guys. It's the little things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. You gotta be careful about those kinds of things.
We use Facebook all the time. I mean, you know, if there were some people who write status updates, you know, stating, oh, I just beat CPS. That bitch doesn't even know what the fuck she's talking about. Like, that'll be the status update. And this is like, what the hell are you doing? Stop it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, that's not being
smart. Don't be an idiot.
You know, that's not being smart. And so what are the chances? Have you ever seen any cases where parents get their children back? Can they fight for this? If so, how long does it take?
Okay.
Is there procedures?
So if you end up going to court, it is 100%, you know, you absolutely need a family court attorney with you. The idea of not getting a family court attorney is like walking up to a gunfight with a spork. I mean, you're going to be completely screwed. These judges, the prosecuting attorneys, the guardian ad litem, all these people are paid for by the state, including the court-appointed defense attorney. So it's important to get your own private attorney. If you think about it, if every single person there is paid for by the same people, what do you think your chances are?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
You're going to be pretty screwed because these court-appointed attorneys, well, they don't get paid for winning, right? They get paid for every single case that they take. So they'll just tell parents, oh, you have no chance of winning. Just do whatever the court tells you to do. It's
right.
Really important not to do that. So it's always recommended to always get a private family court attorney with you. Don't just get any attorney. Make sure it's a family court attorney in that particular case. But yeah, there's a lot of different types of court cases and everything else. And I go through a horrendous amount of a thorough explanation in the book explaining exactly how each one of these works. It's a lot of kind of court legalese speak that isn't exactly the most entertaining stuff to talk about. But essentially, parents can get their kids back, right? As long as the rights have not been completely terminated. And there are certain steps that you have to take in order to be able to do that. The most important things are to always record conversations. Get a family court attorney if you ever go to court. Never say anything that can, you know, be problematic to your own case, and keep thorough records of everything that happens from your day-to-day life ever since your court case started.
Yeah, write everything down if you don't, or record it audio-wise, right? Or a video mm-hmm. camera. Always keep a journal, these kinds of things, because these are yeah. very difficult emotional processes that you go through, and you might not even, as you said before, you might not recall properly, you might not remember, and you're already emotionally upset and everything else. So it's very important to have some kind of objective recording device to do any of this. And that's good to have anywhere, in any capacity, whatever happens anyway. But let's just kind of extend the first segment here a bit, Carlos, and we'll make it one longer segment because there's a few more things I want to squeeze in here. And we'll talk more about the book here a little bit later, where people can go to pick up copies and all that stuff. But on what level then do you think we should fight this? I mean, we can't have an agency like this running around and having this kind of power that it has. Obviously, the very aspect of spreading information, as you're doing, is part of the beginning processes of this solution. But where should this be taken, do you think? And how can we fight something like this? I mean, I guess it goes back to the old question of how do we fight a government that has turned against its own people, you know?
Well, that's a kind of a large question as to how do we go about the destruction of the government? Because personally, I'm not of the mindset that voting is going to get us anywhere, right? Voting for our slaves' masters will do absolutely nothing.
Not getting like good people in government, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, getting great, you know, people into the mafia in order to take down the mafia. I just don't see it happening.
Yep.
An economic collapse is most likely going to be what's going to cause the end of the government. I think education, first and foremost, is incredibly important whenever it comes to dealing with any kind of governmental agency, kind of knowing how to prepare yourself. And also living in a community that stresses the non-aggression principle, that stresses a peaceful way of dealing with your kids, but also a peaceful way of dealing with other people in your group, right? So I work with the Free State Project here in New Hampshire. And, you know, it's a couple thousand people who are all libertarian folks. If someone's having an issue with someone else, or someone else is having a dispute with another person, we don't handle that through the courts. We handle that amongst each other, right? So we actually have a conversation with in regards to how people are treating their kids, right? We also take a hold of how your child's going to be raised, right? So instead of sticking your child in some public school so that they're institutionalized and, you know, possibly abused and drugged, instead you homeschool them, right? So it's important that we try to not spend our entire life trying to get at something that we cannot change, right? It's about the locus of control. What can I do in my own life to best help me? I don't believe that we can reform Child Protective Services out of existence. I think it's something that's going to have to collapse on its own. I believe the same way about the state. But until then, I think knowing how to defend yourself is your best bet for right now.
Let me ask you this. I don't think I asked you this. When did you quit, and what pushed you over that edge to finally stop?
I quit after a little bit over a year of working for the agency. I was, you see a few kids get removed, and you see enough kids crying in front of your face because they're being taken away from their parents. You see parents every single day trying to get their children back, and it really takes a toll on you. And when you realize that there's almost nothing you can do to fix the situation because the agency that you're working for, well, you're the bad guys. You're the bad guys in the movie. You're not the good guys in the movie. And when you come to that realization that everything you're doing is unethical, you have to quit. You just have to. You cannot keep working for an agency like that. There was just no hope. There's no more hope. And I mentally was not capable of dealing with it anymore.
Did you talk with any of your colleagues about this? Did they feel the same way, or what happened there?
My colleagues, here's a fun story. When I started working for the agency, I remember we were in training. I was at lunch, right? And I was sitting there, and I was talking to some people who were in training, and they were talking about what TV show they were watching the night before. And they asked me, what were you watching last night? And I was like, I don't actually have a television. I was reading last night. They're like, what do you mean you're reading? I was like, well, I was on the internet. You know, I was on Wikipedia. You know, you just click one thing, you go to another thing, you just keep reading and everything else. And they go, does your girlfriend, does she also use the Wikipedia? They were made, and then they started making fun of me for the fact that I didn't have cable and that I read when I went home. Essentially, they're making fun of the fact that I was a book nerd, right?
Yep.
These are idiots. There's no other real word for them. It was unbelievable to me that while I was working for the agency, I could not find one other individual that I could empathize with, that I could have a civil conversation with in regards to what was going on. Everyone there was convinced that what they were doing was right. There wasn't one fucking rebel amongst them. And that's a pretty tragic place to be.
Yeah, I know. What's, you know, kind of difficult in some of these situations as well is that, and this tends to happen, and I certainly understand that, but I remember having conversations with other people about having good people in place of these institutions, as opposed to giving up, and instead of tiring, try to persevere and be in there to try to affect things in a positive way. I mean, I understand it a certain way, you just can't take it anymore.
But you'll get fired, though, if you're a good guy, right?
Right, sure.
Because you still have to drug test people. And if after a year and a half, you don't have one positive drug test, they're going to know something's going on, right?
Right.
So if I'm not getting enough removals, what is my supervisor going to do? They're going to start watching after what I'm doing, right? And if you say you didn't end up removing that kid because he was riding his bike three blocks away, and then there's four more reports that come in that, oh, that kid's still riding his bike. Well, who's the supervisor going to go after? They're going to go after you, and then you can get in trouble, right?
Yeah.
So there's only so much you can do until they completely destroy you.
Now, were you close to getting to that situation?
Let's just say that my coworkers were averaging maybe four or five removals a month, and I got like two or three in a year. So essentially, I was starting to get looked at by my supervisor more and more because of the fact that I was apparently not removing enough kids.
So were there, let's just tell us more about that in terms of the money incentive there as well. Did you actually get bonuses when you removed kids, or which is just more on the state level that occurred? Remind us about that again.
Well, you remember that the way bureaucracies work is that the money is never handed directly to anyone. It moves around so that no one ever ends up having to take responsibility for anything, right? So when I was telling you about that $4,000 granted to state agencies for every single child that is removed, well, they handle that to the state agency, and then that kind of goes through, right? But if you truly think about it here, if you get a removal when you're working for CPS and your supervisor sees that, they go, wow, you're a really hard worker. You're really busting your ass out there, right? You're getting your pat on the back, right? So you have that culture there of removing children. Also, the CPS investigators, right? CPS supervisors, CPS as a whole, the only way they can stay afloat is if removals keep coming in and coming in and coming in, because it's showing to the state, well, look, abuse is rampant and we need more and more and more money. So though there might not necessarily be quotas that are given directly to CPS investigators, to think that there's not quotas somewhere would be absurd.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So they do have the pressure.
There has to be a fucking quota somewhere for 400,000 children to be in out-of-home care.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just preposterous.
I wonder, too, where do they find all these other families that line up for that, and how do they manage to get...
Well, they get paid, right?
I mean,
there's foster parents out there who are running a fucking farm of children who have eight kids, right? And for each one of those kids, say, they might be getting $1,000 to $1,500 a month. Right. So we got a foster parent there who has $9,000 to $10,000 a month giving the, you know, feeding the kid Ritalin, Zyprexa, Depakote, and a number of other drugs in order to shut them up so they can keep shuffling in more kids and feeding them shit food.
And is the CPS showing up on that in their door too? Checking in what they're doing?
Oh, on occasion, right? But the thing is, you see, everything I just explained there, none of that is abuse, according to Child Protective Services, right? You got eight kids. Well, they all seem to be shut up because they're all on psychotropic drugs, and the doctor says they're supposed to be on psychotropic drugs. And you're feeding them shitty food like Twix, but guess what? That's FDA approved, and therefore it's healthy, right?
Yeah.
What the state says is good is bad enough.
You know, this is the essence of the scientific dictatorship of keeping people in these kinds of Sims type environments, you know, and just filling up what you need to do on the material level, and that's about it. As long as you're quiet, just as you say, it's happy, you know, you get all the checks in the protocol.
Scientific management of society in order to make it more predictable, right? I mean, that's what it's been about for, that's what progressivism has been about from the beginning. In order to make society predictable, in order to deal with the increase in population, you have to make sure that you know exactly what's going to go on a day-to-day basis. It's the only way to keep central planning going correctly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what public education is about. It's when Child Left Behind is about. That's what the entire state is about. It's about controlling society. And the best way to control society is to control the children.
Yeah, take those over in the early stage of their lives and control them. And of course, it's also very much about you know, celebrating the mediocrity of bringing down everyone to the same level and creating that type of sameness. And I'm sad to have seen that in America too, that it's been very much about, you know, bringing people down to the same level as opposed to, you know, raising up individual achievements and things where, you know, they have natural talents and whatnot. And I see that definitely as a worrying development in the future of all mankind, right? It's this egalitarianism is so celebrated, right? But I don't think people realize what the full consequence of that's going to be 2-3 generations down the line, you know?
Excuse me if I'm wrong, but in Scandinavia, isn't that a large thing too in regards to trying to ensure that no one gets too above anyone else, instilling the egalitarianism? I believe there's like a Swedish word for it. I can't quite recall off the top of my head.
Are you thinking about like lagom or something like that? That term?
Yeah,
that,
there we go.
Yeah, exactly. So
fucking communism.
Although there has been a sound idea in terms of, as I said before, you know, it's a social, kind of a material comfort zone there. It's been, we've been known for that in Sweden, right? Of you know, welfare system and things like that. And although I understand the developments of that and why it slowly led to that, that's now completely run amok. And now that is taking over people's lives and completely telling them how to live. You know, it's just, again, it's just these few checkboxes that you need to have filled to have a, according to the government, a happy existence. And then that's it. You know, it's very much materialistic. It's very much a scientific, and it's based on, of course, on skewed science and wrong numbers and everything else. So we need to break out of that, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that kind of, that hamster wheel that they're calling life, it's going to continue to get worse if we continue to fall for this kind of blanket egalitarianism and trigger warning type society that we're now living in. You know,
yeah.
Everyone has to be taken care of. We have to do trigger warnings on every single article that might hurt someone's feelings. We're basically creating a society of fainting goats.
Yeah, yeah.
And wow, it's way, way easier to control everyone if, you know, every single thing triggers us to, you know, completely pass out. And that's what the government wants, right?
Yeah, a you know, happy, content population, as long as the government's there taking care of them. They're, of course, incapable of dealing with conflict on their own, anything that kind of result in other out of the normal kind of procedures. And again, of course, that's what they want. That's lacking, why people can't organize. That's why we haven't, I believe, charged and tried to dealt with this run amok government already, right? We've are incapable of getting together and cooperating. I think personally that that's part of the war on men as well, that we see all throughout the world, that kind of comes in the guise of progressivism as well. That is very much about destroying what I think are beautiful differences between men and women, and even different ethnicities and race and everything else. It's just complete, just everyone is the same, everyone's equal, that's it. And it's destroying our humanity, you know?
Well, and it's a weird kind of racism that's going on as far as progressivism is concerned, because we're, at the same time, we're supposed to hold men to all these, especially white men, to all these norms, right? But all other races, they're supposed to be essentially treated as children, right? And so the hatred towards white men in America right now is unbelievable.
It is, yes.
And the hatred towards, and this, by the way, is coming from a Puerto Rican guy, so therefore I have no privilege, right? So I don't have to worry about any of this.
Right.
I can say
right.
Whatever I want, and I can take all the welfare I want, and no one's allowed to say anything because white people have privilege.
You have too much European blood in there, that's why. So.
Oh, okay. Goddamn. I don't have enough Taino Indian in me.
Yeah, exactly.
They were knocked out too quickly. But yeah, it's paternalism. It's a culture of fear. And it's the direction of society is going to continue to go that way unless we can really take the reins and be able to move this another way. And I think, you know, radio shows like yours, shows like School Sucks with Brett, and hopefully, you know, the work that I'm being able to put out there, it's going to be able to help in this particular case. But there's a lot of work to be done, man.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I can tell you this much. Anyone who's telling me to vote, I just kind of got to laugh at them. Because it's such a lack of realization of how desperate and pathetic that sounds whenever you see what's really going on in society as a whole right now.
I've said this to Brett as well when we spoke with him, and I think there's part of me that not worries, but I see the a defeatist attitude in waiting. And I'm not saying that this is what you're advocating, but a lot of people have this. They're waiting for the collapse of the system itself. And in the meantime, we cannot stand around in the sidelines. I personally at this stage think we need to fight it at many different angles at once. We need to have many different irons in the fire and look at many different strategies in trying to, you know, disseminate good information. And then at the same time, you know, if there are someone who actually would run for something, wherever it is, to get in and try to stabilize something which is occurring.
And I can understand that. I'm kind of under the stoicism as far as philosophy is concerned. So it's to dedicate your life to something that is without your control inevitably leads to suffering, right?
Well, not everything, but a lot of things in the world are outside of our control, except our own life, right?
So dedicating your life, though, to something that is outside of your control, though, that many times leads to going nowhere, right? So whenever people are chanting, end the Fed, while they have no job, they're getting fat and they're smoking cigarettes all day and talking about chemtrails. To me, that's not really a happy life, right? If this is the only life we have, then we should be trying to go after things that we know we can change. The first one being our own life, getting your own life in order, which I've, you know, worked to kind of do since quitting the agency, economically at least. And then secondly, it's also doing what you know how to do best. So in my particular case, I know how to fight family court. So I go about helping individuals who send me emails who need help legally with child protective services cases, and I'm preventing kids from being taken away from parents time and time and time and time again, right? I'm putting out a book there, which I'm handing out for $3 to be able to help out individuals. So I certainly don't think that by me stating that I don't believe that voting is going to do anything, I am in any way stating that I'm giving up.
Mm-hmm. No, of course not. No, this is, and that's not what I'm saying either. I'm saying it's on those measures. I see a lot of good people that have a lot of, and obviously they should direct their attention on their own lives first, absolutely. But then at the same time, there might be a lot of people waiting in the wings for something external to happen to them. And that's not taking your destiny into your own hands. It's waiting for something else to occur, meaning, you know, the government will collapse. At the same time, I understand the perspective of saying, well, I'll need to have something in place which works when and if that occurs and happens. So again, all of these are life choices that we all make. I just hope that a lot of people are not kind of sitting around and waiting and doing nothing because they believe that the collapse will come, which, you know, when is that going to happen, right?
Absolutely. I completely agree.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your website and things like that and give out some details here, of course. The book we've been talking about is called Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services. You run a podcast, a show that you're doing. I don't know how often you can tell us about that. Give us the details about the website and where people can pick up copies of your book.
Okay. So Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services can be found at legallykidnapped.net. Now, presently, it's only on Kindle. I did a quick free release for a bit. I did for about 5 days and ended up getting number one in all of nonfiction on Amazon Kindle. So I was very excited about that. And now it's available to purchase for $2.99. So you can find it on the website through there.
And my podcast and YouTube channel can be found at truthovercomfort.net. The podcast delves into everything from politics to religion, which I talk about quite a bit, and to the topic of family court and parenting as a whole. So we really go through everything, but I believe a lot can be found in regards to valuable information on that. So,
Well, very good. We're going to have the links up on our website, of course, so people can click through from there easily. So just a final question for you. So is this what you want to do? I mean, it's good work, of course, being a champion for those who have struggles with the CPS, or do you have other things in the pipeline, other things you want to do in the future, Carlos?
To be quite honest, I'm still recovering from basically being in the bottom of a basement while writing, ferociously for the last 4 months. So I will figure it out from here. For right now though, I really enjoy helping out individuals dealing with child protective services. So I'm going to be championing this, for right now, and maybe something next will come in the pipeline.
All right, great. Well, thank you for your time today, Carlos. Really appreciate it. And thank you for speaking out about it as well. We need more people doing that, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, there you have it. More proof to add to the pile of evidence of how screwed up our system is, how our institutions, governments, agencies, and in some cases, even the people themselves have turned on us, and that they no longer are there to oversee our interests. They are working for someone else, towards something else. You know, all of this that we talk about on this program might seem gloomy, but I think you should think about it in a different way. This is our tempering process. This is how a diamond is formed under high, high pressure. I think it's a catharsis that will lead to a rebirth, if you will, and it's not until we are squeezed out of that zone of comfort that you're going to begin to see some very, very interesting things start occurring. And we're going to talk more about that, by the way, in future shows. But we're going to be back in just a few days with Anthony Michels from Holland to talk about usury and the monetary system, the many faults in the system, and how it ties into the bigger picture of the tumultuous times that has been planned for us ahead. We also have Mike King, Kerry Bolton, Laird Scranton, and Robert Ferguson, to name a few, coming up. And you can see the list of upcoming guests in our radio archive on redicecreations.com, redicradio.net, or redicemembers.com. And also, by the way, in the pipeline, program 2 with John Lash, the follow-up to the last one we did as promised, and it's going to be a good one as well, so stay tuned for that. I also want to mention the archives that we have at redicemembers.com for supporters and dedicated audience. We have a lot of topics covered there, and a lot more to cover when it comes to what is happening in the world and what the response should be. For now, we say please take care. We'll speak to you soon. Thank you for listening, and have a great day, everybody. We'll talk to you later.